This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been expressing his politics, his general anti-communist, anti-socialist, imperialist politics, and maybe people have not been listening to what he's been saying.
We look at independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s stance on Israel and Palestine.
The Pequot people were burned alive in the middle of their sleep at night in 1637. Mass Bay Colony, Plymouth Colony, Providence Plantation, Mystic Seaport, all English colonies banded together to burn women and children while they slept in a village at night.
Indigenous people commemorate a day of mourning on U.S. Thanksgiving Day. Working people in Japan speak out about the economic crisis in their country and stand in solidarity with Palestine.
The global convening on reparations brought together people from on the continent of Africa, from the Caribbean community, CARICOM, from the diaspora. We are all demanding reparatory justice, reparations from this country, from Europe.
Throughout the African diaspora, demands for reparations for human trafficking and slavery grow louder. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. As both Republicans and Democrats double down on their support for Israel, Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev and Freddie Libertad take a look at independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s stance.
Independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been rising in the polls, with some on the left even hailing his candidacy as an alternative to the pro-war, pro-corporate duopoly. However, RFK Jr.'s stance on Israel tells a different story. To discuss this, I'm joined by Pacifica contributor Freddie Libertad. Welcome, Freddie.
Hey, how are you?
So RFK Jr. went on the Rubin Report with Dave Rubin in early November. He started out by saying that his goal as president would be to unravel the U.S. empire. But then he changed his tune. So let's hear RFK Jr. and then your comments, Freddie.
My philosophy with America is that we need to unravel the empire.
Okay, so RFK Kennedy Jr. says he wants to unravel the empire, right? This is very clever language. Unravel the empire. What does that mean? So what he talks about is cutting the military budget. He admits that our military budget is more than the next 10 frontrunners combined. So he wants to cut that, which also means that we don't need as many military bases. So he concedes certain things, but that's just another approach to empire. So he's not unraveling anything. He's trying to save money and more effectively manage the empire. Then he gets to what he really means.
And what we need to do is arm ourselves with teeth at home. Oh, we can protect our borders, make ourselves too expensive to ever invade, and then protect the sea lanes, protect the neutral areas like the Arctic, and make sure that we have the resources that are critical to us, including the oil resources that are critical to the world, that we have a strike capacity to make sure to be able to protect those. And Israel is critical. And the reason it's critical is because it's a bulwark for us in the Mideast. It's almost like having an aircraft carrier in the Mideast. It's our oldest ally. It's been our ally for 75 years. It has been an incredible ally for us in terms of the technology, the exchange. Those military expenditures are all going, 75% of it goes to U.S. companies under the agreement, under the MOU.
Because the U.S. gives over $3 billion, I think it's closer to $4 billion now, to Israel. They gave them a lot more this year so that they could commit a genocide, but typically it's, you know, $3 to $4 billion. And he actually says that this is a good thing because he says there's a MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, that 75% of that money that we give them has to go to U.S. companies, right? So he might as well be a weapons lobbyist because he's making the argument that this is such a great thing that 75% of well over $3 billion has to come back to our weapons of mass destruction manufacturers here. So he's very critical about lobbies and, you know, the big pharma, and I'm with him on that. But then here he is talking like a lobbyist for the war industry. The way he's talking about Israel here reminds us of a younger, less cognitively challenged Joe Biden. Back when he said that if Israel didn't exist, and again, he's justifying all this money, the support and the money that we give to Israel. If Israel didn't exist, we'd have to invent it.
Were there not an Israel, the United States of America would have to invent an Israel to protect her interest in the region. The United States would have to go out and invent an Israel.
And this is a consistency of empire. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., even though he might be critical of Biden, or he might be critical of Trump, or people might be critical of him, there's a consistency with empire that it just, certain policies are not really policies. They're imperatives of empire, and they don't change.
All right, let's hear more from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking to Dave Rubin in early November.
If you look at what's happening in the Mideast now, Iran is now, the closest allies to Iran are Russia and China. Iran also controls all of Venezuela's oil. Hezbollah is in Venezuela. They have propped up the Maduro regime, and so they control that oil supply. BRICS, Saudi Arabia is now joining BRICS. So those countries will control 90% of the oil in the world. If Israel disappears, the vacuum in the Mideast, which is, you know, Israel is our ambassador, it's our presence, our beachhead in the Mideast, and it gives us ears and eyes in the Mideast, it gives us intelligence, it gives us the capacity to influence affairs in the Mideast. If Israel disappeared, Russia and China would be controlling the Mideast, and they control 90% of the world's oil supply, and that would be cataclysmic for U.S. national security.
He gives it away when he talks about the oil. That's what it's really about, and that's why we need to have an aircraft carrier in the Mideast, which is Israel. And then he goes on to bash Iran, which is part of what he does. I mean, this is not a new thing, and China. And then he starts making stuff up, which is that Iran controls Venezuela and its oil, and that in fact Hezbollah is also there. So he starts fantasizing. It reminds me of the Cold War, actually, with these fantasies that were not even true. The end of the story that he tells us is that Russia and China, you know, our standard boogeyman, are going to control everything because they're in it with Iran. They're part of the BRICS. And then the U.S. is going to be left out in the cold. That's his basic argument. It's an imperialist argument. It's an argument for empire, regardless of what he says about unraveling empire. He's a politician. He's using a phrase that sounds nice to people. It sounds nice that he's willing to cut the military budget. He's not willing to let the empire go. He is the guy who will manage the empire in his mind, and this is his pitch. He'll manage the empire better than anyone else will. And Israel is going to play a critical role in that, as it plays now.
Now, I'd like us to hear something that Bobby told Pacifica's Don DeBar on April 21st, just days after announcing he would run for president as a Democrat. He spoke about how China was eating America's lunch. His words.
Chinese, during that same period, spent $8.1 trillion building bridges, roads, hospitals, schools, creating goodwill, and they are now eating our lunch all over Africa, all over Latin America. The Brazilians just find a deal to get off the American dollar and go on to the Chinese currency. And, you know, that's going to be that collapse of the American dollar as the global currency will cost us $750 billion a year.
If you're an anti-imperialist, you're wondering what the U.S.'s lunch is doing in Africa, all over Africa. And all over Latin America, you know, we lost our lunch all over these two huge continents. So it's just very revealing. You don't have to think too hard to see that this is imperialist thinking. That's all it is. And it's American exceptionalism because somehow the U.S. has the right to eat someone else's lunch all over Africa and Latin America, because we're doing it for democracy, you know, for whatever, whatever is the current reason for us doing that.
So how do you connect the two statements from RFK Jr.?
In the interview with Dave Rubin, or at least that particular clip, because it's a long interview, he's focusing on the Middle East because of what's going on right now with Israel. He's justifying a genocide by saying how important Israel is as an ally. And he mentions China, of course, and BRICS. But in that clip, he doesn't say anything about Latin America or Africa, right? But that's also important because they have precious metals and minerals that the empire needs, like lithium, like cobalt, etc. So when you put these pieces of the puzzle together, it's completely clear what he's about. He's about continuing the U.S. empire in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, and continuing to be adversaries with Russia and China rather than working in a friendly relationship with them. He's still seeing things as an imperialist, where you're in competition with someone else, which is not what the BRICS is about. It's about mutual cooperation and win-win rather than the U.S. controlling the world economy.
I'd like us to hear about a minute of highlights from Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking on the Jimmy Dore show in early August. That was the first time my jaw dropped.
There's this narrative, and particularly on the liberal left, that says that Israel, that portrays Israel as a kind of occupying nation sitting on a Palestinian land. And the whole thing is a lie from start to bottom. So if you go to Israel and if you kill a Jew anywhere in the world and you're a Palestinian, the Palestinian Authority will pay you money for that. You have, you know, the Palestinian Authority, and in Gaza, if you kill a Jew, you get a street named after you. The children are taught from kindergarten that killing Jews is an act of patriotism, and that it's okay, and that Israel has no right to exist, and their purpose is to destroy Israel and to exterminate the Jewish people. Now, Israel, on the other hand, only deliberately attacks military targets. So civilians do get killed. But for example, in Jenin, you know, in the recent battle over Jenin, Jenin is a bomb factory. It's terrorist bomb factory.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does the same thing in his interview with Dave Rubin in the Rubin Report. It's basically this notion that the Palestinians are terrorists, that they don't want peace, and if that's the case, then they deserve what they're getting. And that's the problem with that, is that then we see what we're seeing now in Gaza. And of course, it's been going on for 75 years. It's not like it just started. Or actually, it's been going on longer than that. Max Blumenthal, who has written a lot on Palestine and who's been to Palestine, who's been to Gaza, offered to have an interview like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And at first it looked like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was going to do it, but I'm not surprised that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Has declined the invitation to do an interview with Max Blumenthal. He's not going to do that. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a very savvy lawyer. He knows his stuff when it comes to suing people. And I applaud him for this, for suing Monsanto, for using Roundup, and suing companies for putting toxins in the environment that end up in our food, right? So he's done some good things, and he's very knowledgeable about that. He's afraid of, and he won't debate or do an interview with someone like Max Blumenthal, with someone like Dan Cohn, with someone like Norman Finkelstein, or Miko Peled, or any of these people who would do what he would do to someone else on these other issues, where he would say, people don't want to debate me on, he would say this, he would make this statement on COVID, because I'll embarrass them. And the thing is, you know, a lot of people that were critical of him did not take him up. They didn't want to debate him on the issue of COVID mandates, the efficacy of the vaccine, how it came about, et cetera, et cetera. And he's doing that now, where he's refusing to debate on this issue that he's taken a very hardline stance on, the Palestinians and Israel. He's refusing to debate people who could set him straight and expose him in real time.
Well, it's not that he just doesn't want to debate these particular people on Israel. He doesn't think the pro-Palestinian point of view should even be part of the debate.
Precisely, right. By taking a public stand on, like, he applauded a billionaire, actually. He's supposed to be critical of elites, which he is one. He is an elite, critical of, someone named Ackman, who was celebrating that these students are being censored at different universities. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. came out, like, applauding that and saying that there should be quote-unquote, zero tolerance. So he's calling for censorship, and he's not being specific. There are already laws against physically intimidating people, but that's not what we're talking about. He doesn't want to have this debate about the Palestinians' right to have their country.
All right, so what is then Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s ideology, in your opinion?
His ideology is classic American exceptionalism. He went on the Jimmy Dore show months ago when he announced his candidacy or shortly thereafter. And he was talking about what's the so-called frontier thesis. This is from 1893. It's a historian, Frederick Jackson Turner. It's a classic thesis, right? And basically, it's sort of the thesis or the cornerstone of American exceptionalism. Not that it didn't already exist, but it really spelled it out for academics, as an ideology, for politicians, and it had a lot of currency for the next 100 plus years. The fact that he's referring to something from the late 1800s, right? The so-called closing of the frontier, what does that mean? It means that finally the Native American people have been subdued. That's what that means. It's a genocidal thesis that he references. The frontier thesis is basically this notion that so-called American democracy is born out of the experience of the frontier. So basically, it's born out of the experience of genocide, of moving the frontier further and further west, manifest destiny, which is a term that was coined before the frontier thesis, a few decades prior to that. There are two sides of the same concept. America keeps pushing westward, and it's this individualism of the people on the frontier that are central to the character of Americans and the character of American democracy. I mean, it's just rubbish. It's very strange that in 2023, this should be clearly seen as a genocidal outlook, ideology. And this has been challenged for decades now, since the 60s, and certainly in the 80s and 90s. It's strange that he is regurgitating this theory that's been debunked or exposed as a theory that legitimizes empire and genocide of Native peoples here. And it makes sense when you're talking about Israel, because they're doing the same thing with the Palestinians. And he may not see it, but we should see it for what it is. And they're saying it out loud too, that they need to push the Palestinians out. Once and for all, they need to finish the Nakba. And that aircraft carrier and the beachhead, back in the day, those were the forts of the U.S. Army. Those were the settlements of the settler colonialists that kept pushing and pushing and pushing Native Americans onto reservations.
So many people on the left were shocked and almost speechless, I would say, when we heard Bobby Jr.'s Likudnik-like fervor when defending Israel. Why is that, you think?
Probably because they haven't really been listening to what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been saying for a while now. He's been expressing his politics, his general anti-communist, anti-socialist, imperialist politics, an enlightened version of that, but still, it's a politics of empire. And maybe people have not been listening to what he's been saying, which they should if they're considering voting for somebody. And if they're going to talk about somebody so highly, they might actually want to follow what he's been saying politically. A lot of people have felt supportive of him to some degree because maybe they were upset with the COVID mandates. He was someone who spoke up against those, like vaccine mandates, etc. You know, on the left, unfortunately, a lot of us who consider ourselves socialists or leftists felt abandoned by other people on the left who just swallowed the whole narrative on COVID without questioning it at all. So as people on the left, we should be questioning everything, particularly when it has to do with corporations and with war. So a lot of people didn't do that. That's a whole other discussion, but it opened a door to a lot of people feeling supportive of him because he did criticize Big Pharma. And he does have a track record with environmental issues, cleaning up rivers, etc. So he does have that track record. And the other thing I think is that, unfortunately, a lot of people are looking for a hero or a messiah. He has the Kennedy name, so there's that mystique.
Is there an underside to that mystique?
He is a rabid anti-communist, as were his father and his uncle and his grandfather. That's who they are. He likes to call himself a free market capitalist. His father actually worked briefly for the infamous Joe McCarthy of McCarthyism fame. His grandfather, the father of RFK Sr., and John F. Kennedy, was on very friendly terms with Joseph McCarthy. Joseph McCarthy was in the Republican Party. The Kennedys are Democrats, but they supported each other's campaigns, the Kennedy family. It's a dynasty, right? When the grandfather Kennedy, that is the father of RFK and Robert F. Kennedy Sr., when he died, I believe it was in 69, Seymour Hersh reported that he was worth about $500 million. So in today's terms, that would be in the billions. So this is a family. It's a ruling class family. They didn't become ruling class because, you know, they had a president in there. They were already part of the ruling class. And that's whose interests they represent. They always have, and they do now.
Thank you, Freddie. That was Pacifica contributor Freddie Libertad. For Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, I'm Paulina Vasilyev.
Someone makes a move of which we don't approve. Who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines. We'll send them all we've got. John Wayne and Randolph Scott. Remember those exciting fighting scenes? To the shores of Tripoli, but not to Mississippi. What do? We send the Marines. For might makes right. Until they've seen the light, they've got to be protected, all their rights respected, till somebody we like can be elected. Members of the Corps all hate the thought of war. They'd rather kill them off by peaceful means. Stop calling it aggression. Ooh, we hate that expression. We only want the world to know that we support the status quo. They love us everywhere we go. So when in doubt, send the Marines.
That was Tom Lehrer, Sending the Marines. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Since 1970, Indigenous people and their allies have gathered at noon on Coles Hill in Plymouth, Massachusetts, to commemorate a National Day of Mourning on the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday. It's no holiday for Indigenous people, to whom Thanksgiving Day represents the genocide, theft, and erasure of Indigenous cultures. Capitalism, Race, and Democracy honors Indigenous ancestors and Native resilience with this presentation from a National Day of Mourning speech in 2012 by Ananwan Whedon, who is Mashpee Wampanoag. He spoke about the reality of Thanksgiving while holding a mounted, fake, bloody head on a spike.
Mystic Massacre is what we call it. The Pequot War. It goes by many names. It happened in 1637 down in Connecticut. Owners of the now established Foxwoods. The Pequot people were burned alive in the middle of their sleep at night in 1637. Mass Bay Colony, Plymouth Colony, Providence Plantation, Mystic Seaport, all English colonies banded together to burn women and children while they slept in a village at night. They barricaded the exit. They did not allow anyone to leave. They wanted them to burn. They were proud that they burned. This country was proud to write. We could smell their burning, rotting flesh for over a mile away. It's written, folks. Please read it on your own. I am not making this up. Stephen King can't make this up. He was so proud the town of Norwich, Connecticut, had a statue honoring this man up until roughly a decade ago. John Mason, the man who murdered over 700 people. When anyone, the few people who were able to survive that Holocaust, they were rounded up. They were sold as slaves. Before they were sold, they were marched all the way from Connecticut to Mass Bay Colony, present-day Boston. They were placed on trial. They were declared to be sold as slaves. But before they sent them on that slave ship, they had to humiliate them some more. And they read a declaration that those people shall not ever, once again, even utter the word Pequot. They will no longer be able to call themselves a Pequot. I am proud to say I'm a Mashantucket Pequot. This is the history, folks. Because that particular day, that particular incident, is when this country declared its second religious day of Thanksgiving. This is what we're celebrating, folks. And for all of you who took pictures of me with my nice little pilgrim head buddy here, I hope you get the story that goes with it, because anyone who sees this, I'm sure, thinks I'm a sick, twisted individual. This is a reminder. This is what Hallmark greeting cards and Charlie Brown cartoons should be showing when we celebrate this holiday every year, when we celebrate Columbus Day every year, because this is what it represented. Because we need all of you who are here to get this story out to the people. I can only visit so many schools in this time that I am here on this earth. And I can only visit those who are welcome to hearing the truth and invite me to do so. I encourage all of you to do the same. I look out and I see in this crowd, I see some people that I've been at their schools, and they are here now standing in solidarity. I really appreciate this. It means they're listening. Somebody's listening, and they don't appreciate what's going on. This symbol right here, we're going to march all the way around, and we're going to make one stop at the church where King Philip's head sat on a pole until it rotted for over 20 some odd years. For those of you who do not know who King Philip was, he was the man who started the most patriotic uprising this country will ever see, when its native people stood against these forces. And this manner of warfare, during King Philip's war, when King Philip abducted Mary Rawlinson, she reported in her own writings, she was treated with far greater respect by this savage than she was by her own people. Our women were topless. There was no rape. We did not need abortions. The word Matumwasus is what we call our women. It does not mean woman. It means she who makes all decisions. We had a high respect for our women. That was something pilgrims never understood and still does not translate into America today. Square buildings that cost us so much to heat, to build, to cool, because we're sheltering ourselves from what's going on in the natural world. I've never seen a bird build a square bird's nest. That is the most absurd thing, and Americans still repeat this European nonsense. When are we going to come up and show the rest of the world what should have always been there when we first tried to get our teachings across in the 1600s? Listen to us. We're not saying we're better. We're just saying this works in nature. This here pole, King Philip, when he was killed, he was cut into pieces. The man who killed him was a Wampanoag, shot him in his own back. He got the hand of King Philip, Metacom. He got to parade around anywhere in New England, any tavern he showed up with that scarred hand of Philip. He got free drinks as long as he was there, because people were proud of him, that he had killed his own people. His head was severed, King Philip's head. King Philip is the son of Massasoit. Massasoit comes running to these people's aid just a generation before. And that's when they supposedly had their first Thanksgiving. Well, their third day of Thanksgiving was declared when they brought his son's head in on a pole and left it to rot for 20 odd years. So I'm going to walk this around Plymouth right now, and I'm going to remind folks of what we're celebrating here today. And I encourage all of you to get out to a library, get out to a school. Even if it's your own, it better be your own kid's school, because this is what they're teaching your kids. I excuse my kids from school whenever they're being asked to dress up as pilgrims and Indians. There's so many injustices still going on every day here, folks. every day. This language I have to speak just so people understand me on my own continent is a tragedy. I hate these clothes. There is so much we talk, there's pavement on my hunting grounds. Our clams being polluted. These clams make my stories. My ink doesn't smear. We need our history. Many of us still believe the origins for why we were put here in the first place, to protect this land and to maintain the balance amongst all creations. Plant, animal, winged, fished, finned, does not matter. We are all beings here on our Mother Earth. So I'm going to ask all of you to please stand with me. I don't care what race you are. I don't care what religion you're from. We're human beings, and we need to stand up for humanity.
That was Ananwan Widen. The National Day of Mourning is a day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest against the racism and oppression that Indigenous people continue to experience worldwide. Unity song. That was the American Indian Movement Unity Song, All My Relations. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Dan Garrison. On Monday, November 20, workers in Osaka, Japan, who are members of the Minato Godo Shoshi Metals Branch Union, launched a one-day strike for higher wages and against the ongoing genocide in Palestine. It was the union's first strike in decades. Students who were supporting the strike spoke out. There was also an international rally in Tokyo where workers talked about the growing economic crisis. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer covered these events on the ground in Japan.
You're on strike now. What are the issues on your strike?
The two issues. One is that usually the Japanese company give twice a year bonus type thing, so money. But this year, the amount that they propose is so low, so they wanted to go strike. Second issue is on anti-war, against the war, Palestinian attack. So those two issues are the key one.
I am a student in the Japanese university in Hyogo, and I am helping out the labor movement because eventually I am going to become a worker for sure, and I needed to. Well, this I believe this nation is going to war, and. And myself, as a part of the workers' class, need to have a mission to stop that war. And the Kishida dynasty says that it is preparing for a war against China.
And are you surprised by this action here? It seems like it's the first in Japan of workers having a strike, not only around their own wages and conditions, but also in solidarity with the Palestinians against the bombing of Gaza?
Well. This is actually my first time actually participating in an organized strike. So, yes, I am very, I should say that I'm very shocked, and I am also very excited. In theory, I did know that the workers class could unite together to work as a class and stop wars. But today, I think it was proven by the action that was participated by the Minato Godo Union.
And this union has a long history. Tanaka Machinery Works fought against the shutdown. The Capitals tried to close down this whole district because it was a militant trade union district. You think there's a revival going to take place in Japanese working class?
Before the COVID-19 breakout, the Japanese was completely ignorant or simply does not know about anything about the labor unions or labor movements in that matter. But during the COVID-19 breakout, the union of the doctors and the people that work in hospitals initiated a strike, and that was introduced very widely on the media. And since then, I feel like more and more strikes are being taken place by labor unions.
And the cost of living here is going up, inflation is going up, but wages, there hasn't been a real wage increase for a large number of Japanese workers for years.
Yes, and in number, yes, the wages are not rising at all in I believe the past 20 years. And the price of the consumer goods and the foods that you need to survive are getting more expensive. So in practice, it's actually being kind of like a
wage cut. And the students also have faced increased fees and the cost of living for students.
Yes, the students in Japan, I believe more than about half of them are not wealthy enough to afford a fully a college education. So what they do is they kind of can get a student loan, which they have to
So they're going into debt.
Yes.
Becoming debtors to capitals.
Yes. And every day the news tells about people killing themselves, suiciding, or desperately killing people because of unemployment and low wages and simply just having a very horrible work condition. Such as sexual and power harassment. So people are definitely not looking forward to getting a job.
Hi, my name is Shoko Tomita. I live in Tokyo, Suginami, and I work for Suginami Ward after school kids' place. It's a public owned thing, 150 primary school kids come after school, and we gotta take care of them until 7 o'clock till their parents come and pick up. It's like a nursery kind of situation. And I worked there for about 10 years, and I was able to join the union as a theatrical worker.
Now this is public work,
yeah.
But there's a threat of privatization, of outsourcing.
Yeah. 20 years ago, there was 40 kids' place public owned, but they have been privatizing more than 25 of them, and it's only 26 place, public owned place left, and the rest is privatized. All the workers have been laid off, and the thing is that the childs can't pick the place. If it's public or privatized, they can't pick. They have to go where their school is. So even if the privatized situation is not as good as the public-owned nurseries, they have to go and, they have to spend their time where they have to go. So we have been fighting as a union to stop the privatization, don't lay off the workers. And originally, it should be public work, but as soon as they privatize the work for childcare workers, it turns into a service. They have to do the service for the parents. We have to do this service for the kids, and it's a completely different thing for the kids too.
And the government is complaining about the fact that Japanese are not having children.
That's true.
What are the reasons? Because the government says that they're concerned about it, but it seems like they're not providing enough care and services for parents.
In fact, the total of the kids' birth is lessing, but the working parents are increasing. So the number of the kids that come to our place is non-stop increasing right now. It used to be only 50 kids in one place. It was the normal average, but now it's 150. So it's like a pool of kids, and we have to watch them all and take care of them all. So the best way is to build more of our place, public place, but the government saying that we have to have more kids, but they are not doing the same, giving us the situation that we are able to have kids in feeling, you know, safe. After this, the thing in Gaza happened, when we go on the street and demonstrate, all the young people raise their hands and come join our demonstration, and I see that it's no more allergy against the movement for the young people in Japan also, because they see everybody demonstrating and fighting back on internet and Facebooks and all that kind of...
So social media is being used.
Definitely encouraging Japanese young people.
And breaking the information blockade?
Yes.
The government is not providing information?
They don't believe Kishida, not at all. I mean, Japanese young people don't watch the TV. They don't read newspapers. They go online.
Those were voices from rallies in Osaka and Tokyo, Japan, reported by Pacifica's Steve Seltzer.
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The US government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been working, I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca, and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like Palestinian children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip-hop. For the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, the lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster and Melly Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar López, it's time to get in the field. I'm with a Blue Jamal, I'm with a Sada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the mall, got he getting a penny more.
That was Rebel Diaz, Which Side Are You On? A recent report titled Report on Reparations for Transatlantic Chattel Slavery in the Americas and the Caribbean concluded that under international law, slaving nations owe staggering sums. The analysis, known as the Brattle Report, estimates that the global cost of the slave trade could be as high as $131 trillion U.S. dollars, both for harm perpetrated during the slave era and damages caused post-enslavement. Attorney Nkeshi Taifa, host of Equal Rights and Justice Radio on WPFW, has more details.
This is Nikichi Taifa, host of Human Rights and Justice. I just want to say a few words about a trip that I took. I just got back from Accra, Ghana, from the global convening on reparations that brought together people from on the continent of Africa, from the Caribbean community, CARICOM, from the diaspora in Europe, and from the diaspora in the United States. And it was, indeed, a riveting convening. Opening the conference, Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, said, quote, "The entire period of slavery meant that our progress economically, culturally, and psychologically was stifled. There are legions of stories of families who were torn apart. You cannot quantify the effects of such tragedies, but they need to be recognized," he said. He said the entire continent of Africa deserves a formal apology from the European nations involved in the slave trade. And he added, quote, "No amount of money can restore the damage caused by the transatlantic slave trade and its consequences, but surely this is a matter that the world must confront and can never ignore." And, I it's just kind of hard to fathom just what I felt being on the continent of Africa with my brothers and sisters from the continent of Africa and across the diaspora. We also had the opportunity, and I know this was my third time in Ghana, to visit the Elmina. They call it castle. I call it dungeons because that's what it actually was. It was dungeons where Africans were imprisoned as prisoners of war before being forced into the ships that would carry us to the Western Hemisphere here. And, for those who have been, you saw the male slave dungeon, you saw the female slave dungeon, you saw the Catholic Church, and you saw the governor's mansion, and you saw the deprivation and the pain, and just being there, oh, gosh, it just makes your blood boil. It absolutely makes your blood boil that people can be so vicious to subject other human beings to the depravity that we were subjected to. And the so many of us that did not even make it to the Western Hemisphere, that were thrown overboard into the mouths of, waiting sharks. I mean, oh my gosh. The men, the women, the children, the babies, the unborn, the rapes, the torture, all of that. When we talk about reparations, when we talk about reparatory justice, we're not talking in the abstract. These were very specific acts of which the repercussions are living today as what we call the living legacies of the enslavement era. Who's going to pay reparations on my soul? That's something that I always say over and over again, Gil Scott-Heron. Who's going to pay reparations on my soul? One of the things I loved about the convening in Accra, besides seeing my brothers and sisters from the continent, as well as those from the Caribbean who are part of the CARICOM, the Caribbean nations that have come together also, is that everyone is singing the same tune. We are all demanding reparatory justice, reparations from this country, from Europe, from all of the entities that had, a hand. And, there have been little things here and there, little apologies here and there, but there has not been a comprehensive healing and amends and apology and reckoning. And that's what we are still seeking. So when we look at what our guests were talking about today with respect to the California Reparations Task Force, California being the first state to pass legislation authorizing reparations task force commission to look into, to study the issues in that jurisdiction and make recommendations. They completed their 2-year process. I was one of the people amongst dozens upon dozens upon dozens who testified before the task force. They have issued their recommendations. So a final report of over 1,000 pages and are waiting now on the legislature to bring some of those recommendations into being into existence. So while those on the African continent are mobilizing, while those in the Caribbean community are mobilizing, while those in Europe, African descendants are mobilizing, we in the United States are organizing and mobilizing as well. And as we come towards recognition of Indigenous Peoples or Native American Heritage Month, and we have family gathering really on that day, we need to really think about the Native American genocide that happened on the soil. We need to think about the African enslavement and genocide that happened on this soil. And we need to recognize that there needs to be comprehensive repair, amends, apology, justice, all of the above, truth-telling, you know, in the light. I remind you to go to supportreparations.org to sign up to endorse the recommendations. And if you're looking for any basic information about reparations, to visit my website, www.reparationeducationproject.org. And that's reparation without the S. And you'll find many different resources about the issue of reparations. I talk about it a lot on human rights and justice because it is a human rights and justice issue. It is an issue whose time has come.
That was attorney Nkeshi Taifa, host of Equal Rights and Justice Radio on WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C.
Written many directions for the aid that was given. They gave us pieces of silver and pieces of gold. Tell me who paid reparations on my soul. Many fine speeches. Never really there, yes, but the heat in the summer was there and the freezing winter's cold. Now tell me who'll pay reparations on my soul. Call my brother a junkie. Can't depend on no one else.
That was Gil Scott-Heron, Who'll Pay Reparations on My Soul? And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Akua Holt, Steve Seltzer, Jacqueline Batiste, Fahima Sek, Freddie Libertad, and Polina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.